Sunday, weekly share is not the same as a special event. So there are moments of ebb and flow. You know, there's not always going to be some Republican, whatever. This is a share that we have every week, so this is So wherever we're up to is where we're up to. I guess I have to give a disclaimer ahead of time. Yeah, we're learning the Perek Hakra in Mishle, and we are in the Perek Yud Gimel. And for those of you that are familiar, you know already there are problems in learning Mishle. One of the problems is that the psukim are very short, and they tend not to be connected one pasuk to the other. And even the commentary of the Gra is not always machaber the psukim, that the psukim are often each one is a separate idea. Another problem we have in Mishle is an opposite problem, that sometimes the same idea seems to be repeated many, many times. And it's not always very borer what the differences are. And sometimes the Gra teaches us what the differences are, other times not. Other times the same idea will be repeated a lot of times. Now in Musar, that's not a chisaron though. Yeah, you have to remember. I mentioned before that Rabbi Yisrael Salanter said when he was Madrich people in Musar and Avodas Hashem, he said that learning Musar should have two separate chalakim. There is the intellectual component of Musar, where you pick up new ideas, new understandings. And then that there is what he called Musar v'hispalus, which is really the hispalus, or hispalus as we say in the Yeshiva world, is emotional arousal. And that would be where you take one Maimer Chazal, one Pasuk, it's like a mantra lahavdil. And you simply say the pasuk over and over and over and over again. It might be a pasuk Shivisi Hashem Lenegdi Tamid, or it might be a Maimer Chazal, Da Ma Shelamala Mimcha, know what is above you. And you say it over and over, and even though you know what the pasuk says, you know it's a million times already. But by saying it over and over, it penetrates your heart and it emotionally changes you. And he advocated that a person has to divide his Musar, his working on himself, into both the intellectual component of Musar, which involves learning ideas, and the emotional idea of Musar, Musar b'is Pallas. In fact, I think I had mentioned that actually in the Perek that we happen to be learning, which is Perek Yud Gimel, there is a phrase, Yesh Nispa B'loi Mishpat, wait, before I read Perek Yud Beis. We actually had that pasuk very recently. Yesh nispe b'loi mishpat. I think it's at the end of... Yes. In fact, we're going to actually look at that pasuk. But in Perek Yud Gimel, pasuk Chaf Gimel, the second half of the pasuk says, Yesh nispe b'loi mishpat. And that means there are people who are gathered to God, meaning they die, without judgment, without justice. Now what does that mean? That certainly doesn't mean there's no justice. Whatever Hashem does is right, but it means that sometimes a person dies not because of their averus, not because they're chayav misa, but they die because of the sins of the generation. They die as a kapara. And it's a very tragic thing when a person who still had the potential to do mitzvahs and do so much good for the world is simply nichlal in a gezar din on the door because the door was not worthy of him. So I mention this in connection with Musar b'is Pilus because it is said in Rav Yisrael Salanter for a lot of his life. People don't realize this. You know, we think of Rav Yisrael Salanter, a great guy and a great tzaddik, one of the Gedolei Hador, but he spent a lot of his life wandering from city to city in places where there were no religious Jews. He spent them, he was a Litvish person, he was from Vilna, or Salant is a suburb of Vilna. But he spent most of his adult years in France and in Germany, in places where there were very, very few religious people. And he was mamash makariv people in college campuses. He even taught himself German because he wanted to give shiurim in German.
Translate the Talmud into French.
He had a plan. It wasn't fully carried out to translate Gemaras into German and French, and the like. He had no parnassah. In fact, for a long time, he did not want to take any money for teaching Torah. So he taught himself different skills, different trades. For a while, he wanted to be a stockbroker. But then he concluded that the halachic problems of running a business are greater than being a rabbi or a shiva. So he said, So ultimately, he was supported by different people. There were people who took care of him. I mean, he lived as a nunny, but they gave him food, gave him shelter. So there was such a person in Germany who was not such a big Talmud Chacham, but he was a very big Baal Tzedakah. He had a very good heart. He was Machzik Torah. And he was very, very important to Rabbi Yisrael, just to help Rabbi Yisrael live, basically. And this person died very suddenly, leaving a very big mishpacha. And not only that, but so many people were dependent on him, and a lot of that support stopped. So it is recorded just in the histories of the time. This was maybe 1870 or something. If Yisrael Soloveitchik got up to give a hesped, and all he said for half an hour, was this pasuk, Yesh nispe b'lai mishpat. Yesh nispe b'lai mishpat. And it is recorded that the whole shul broke down in weeping and sobbing as they understood the enormity of what it means when a tzaddik is taken from the world, not because of his averus, but because of our averus, and what a loss it is for us. So that's a classic example of Musar b'hispailus. So in a sense, when the same idea is repeated, we don't always have to, you know, no. I mean, often there will always be a subtle difference, but it doesn't always have to be. Repetition itself is sometimes something that's nichnas into the life. You know, what did somebody say? I heard from Rav Lapiansky. I don't know if you know Rav Aaron Lapiansky. He's a very chashuv person. He used to live here. I think he still lives here. I don't know, part of the time. But he's the Rosh Yeshiva in the Washington Yeshiva, the Silver Spring Yeshiva.
You can buy an article on him, Mishpacha this week in English.
Oh, really? Oh, okay.
The feature article. Okay. Pictures on the...
Okay, so it's worthwhile. He's a very, very chashuv person. Big Baal Machshava, and... if any of you know anyone that needs to go to Chutz La'aretz, this would be a yeshiva to consider. Not that you should leave here for that, but if you're going to leave anyway, it is a good makam. So somebody once mentioned to him that he repeated a shir that he gave last year or something. It wasn't the right thing to say. We all repeat, but he said, you know, you ate the same chocolate kakash of your grandmother this year that you ate last year. You don't seem to get tired of them. So, and you know, there is a point that, you know, repeat. Chavitz Chaim often would say the same. In fact, Chavitz Chaim gave him Musar Shmuz. And Rav Elchanan, who was already a Rosh Yeshiva, Rav Elchanan was a Talmud of the Chavitz Chaim. He would leave his yeshiva for Elul to be with the Chavitz Chaim for Elul. So somebody said to Rav Elchanan, you know, Chavitz Chaim said the same Shmuz last year. So Rav Elchanan said, no, there are four words that are different. That's how he was animated on the teachings of the Chavitz Chaim. Okay, but be it as it may, those are going to be some problems that we're going to have, and there's not always going to be a good teretz. Certainly, even as amazing as the Gross commentary is, and there are other mafarshim as well, but there's still, as Chazal say, Makom hiniach lanu lehiskader. What does that mean? That even after all of the great Torah that was said, you can sometimes be margish, there are areas that still Hashem is still saying there's further development. And I think in Mishlei there vaday is, because I know we encounter a lot the problem of repetition and also the connection of psukim that are hard to see. Yeah.
Is it possible that something is, let's say, repeated, it's in three times,
yeah,
but the first time is telling you that lesson, and the second time, it's right next to another pasuk, Svichas, and it's supposed to, the flow of that thing will connect up to it, ignite, and enlighten the other one.
Yeah.
And therefore, I thought it looks like it's a repetition,
yeah,
but it has an effect upon that. It's necessary to be there to enlighten
the
surrounding
verses. That's actually a very interesting approach. Of course, again, you're getting harder to apply, easier to say than to apply, necessarily, but that's a very good approach, that sometimes the tachlis of a repetition is not for the idea that it states, but for the giloy that it might shed on a new pasuk, a new idea, that the repetition will allow you to understand the new idea in a better way. Okay, so be it as it may, so the pasuk that we're up to in this is, we're up to the last, literally the last verse in Perek Yud Gimel, the last pasuk. This is Perek Yud Gimel, pasuk Chafei. And again, it is a pasuk that, an idea that we've come to before. By the way, the pasuk before, we learned it, but I'll mention it for the people who were. The pasuk was a very, very famous pasuk. Countless Puritans used to use it a lot. and that is Chosech Shifto Sone Beno. This is one of the most famous in the secular world, in the Christian world, it is one of the most famous verses in Proverbs, and that is the verse that is translated, he who spares the rod, he who spares the stick, hates his son. The Oava, and if you truly love your son, Shicharo Musar, you will give him plenty of discipline. And what this pasuk is saying is the basic idea that we sometimes think that if I let my kid do whatever he wants to do, that's how I show love. And if I put boundaries and say, don't, I'm kind of right. A child might even say, I think from children do it less, but you know, they say, I hate you, because you're not letting me do this and that. So Shlomo HaMelech is Megala that if you love somebody, you give them boundaries. Now, here's an important comment. The Gra and the later Bali Musar say as well that although this literally says, if you withhold the shevet, you withhold the staff from your son, you hate him, which suggests that the best thing to do is hit your child. But the Gra says hitting is not understood, chas v'shalom, as physical abuse that causes pain. Hitting, he says, you hit with a shoelace, so to speak. You hit with a noodle. Meaning to say, hitting is the symbolic expression that there are rules in the world. And one has to learn, it's just the process of maturation, that not everything you want to do is something that you want to do. I mean, this is, right? So he who simply withholds discipline is not acting out of love for the child, but it means he doesn't care enough. I don't care enough. In fact, the Chazal tell us, the reason why the Umos HaOlam get away with such, like Klal Yisrael does Averos, and we have Chorban and Golos, and the Umos HaOlam do things that are even worse, much worse. And they can last for a long time. Why is Hashem tougher on the Jewish people? So Chazal says, it's really psukim, because Hashem loves us more. Hashem loves us. When he loves us, when we're makokel, we're not going in the right derech, he wants to correct us. You know, if my son is doing something wrong, I will correct him. If I see somebody else's child, I might be less likely to do that, because I feel less of a connection. Ideally, perhaps I should correct other people's children too, but today you'll get in trouble with the parents. It's not it's not advisable. But you know, going back in the 1950s, the concept was, you know, in the American community, every neighbor was like a surrogate parent. You know, if a neighbor saw a child misbehaving, the neighbor would even, you know, hit the child or whatever it is. And it was makubal. Today it's not makubal anymore. They'll call the police on you. Not only that, you hit your own child, they'll call the police on you. There's a football player, I think, is in very big trouble. He says he hit, gave his child a spanking. And he's going, big money. He's going to lose his NFL contract. I mean, there's millions and millions and millions of dollars because he did a spanking. And he said, he's not abusive. He just said, that's how I was raised, you know, and that's how I raised my child. And all of a sudden, it's not accepted anymore. But the Grub makes the point. The point is not, God forbid, to hurt a child. But the point is that a child needs to know there are boundaries in the world, that we're not in the world to do whatever we want. And if you let a child do whatever he wants, that's a simon that you don't care enough. Right? So that's what it says. Chosech Shifte Sene B'nai. Now, there was a Maisa, I think I've told this Maisa before. The Busna Rebbe, the old Busna Rebbe, of Levi Yitzchak, Zecharenu Levracha, who I used to think Boston was a city in the Ukraine. I didn't realize, but I first heard about Busna Rebbe, I didn't know. But Busna Rebbe is, you know, the city of Boston, Massachusetts. His father, of Levi Yitzchak's father, after World War I, came to Boston and started a Hasidus, and then his son was Rav Levi Yitzchak, who's now not alive anymore, and in Eretz Yisrael, the Boston Rebbe is now Rav Meir Horowitz, and in Boston it's Rav Natzali Horowitz. But Rav Levi Yitzchak, the first Boston Rebbe, or the second Boston Rebbe, the one that was Nifter. So I remember, Baruch Hashem, I was able to be pretty close to him, because I was in Boston myself for 3 years. And I used to spend a lot of Shabbos there. I mean, me and another 100 other people. It wasn't like just me. But he once said that his father very much believed in corporal punishment. If you misbehaved, you got hit, because he felt literally that was the discipline that taught a child right and wrong, midos and hadracha. But he said one thing about his father, that his father would always wait 24 hours. That if he did something wrong that his father felt deserved a patch, father didn't hit him right away. He waited 24 hours, because the father said, for me to hit my child because I'm angry. What's that? I'm angry and I hit somebody? That's chayvo b'chaveru. I'm angry and I hit somebody? It's a form of child abuse. 24 hours, I then think, is this the best chinuch for my child? Is this what he needs? And then I do it l'shem shamayim, because this is what the child needs. Then it becomes a mitzvah. The very same thing when you do it out of anger. It can be a tremendous aveira. And the katan can't even be meichel, because only a gadol could be meichel. Right? The katan, you do something to a katan, you have no mechila. A katan is not a bar mechila. Remember I told you the story with the stipler, that he once said something to a 9-year-old child, and he showed up at the child's bar mitzvah. He walked 3 miles when he could barely walk 3 feet to ask the child's mechila, because he said he was 9 years old, he couldn't be meichel. What did he say? He saw him on Yamim Narayim, and he sees the child holding a big sefer. He thought it was a gemara. He told the child it's time to daven. It turned out it was a machzer for his grandfather, a gigantic machzer, so his grandfather could see. So the stipler said, when is your bar mitzvah? And 4 years later, in the middle of a bar mitzvah that's 3 miles away, the stipler shows up. And you know, again, it must have taken him 3 hours to walk, whatever, even if it was only 1 mile. And he shows up, and everyone is like, they're frozen in place. The stipler, the gadol hador, shows up. I mean, they didn't invite him because they didn't know him, number one. They wouldn't be matriach on him to come. But so amazing. And he's huffing and puffing and barely breathing. You know, couldn't breathe. And he goes over to the child, and he talks to the child, and the child says, and nods his head. And the stipler turns around and walks out, and then walks another. And well, the stipler had all sorts of chumras, because, you know, the stipler, if it was raining on Shabbos, and he had a little hole in his shoe, he would not walk. He would sit in the rain, because he was cheshish for sechita, squeezing water out of his sock. So there were many times where, whatever it is, for various reasons, he would, like, sit in the rain on Shabbos and just walk back, whatever it would be. So everybody rushes over to the boy. He says, What did he say? He says, well, he asked my mechila for what he said to me 4 years before, and I was mochel, and he gave me a bracha for hatzlacha, my bar mitzvah. That's what he said. But the limud is that kids are not hefker, meaning to say, because it's your child, that doesn't mean you can say lashon hara about him, you can make jokes about him, you can make fun of him, you can hit him. So on one hand, when it's being done for chinuch, it becomes a mitzvah. And if you don't do it, it's an aveira. Choseich, shiftei, sonei b'nai. But if you do it because, you know, he's your kid, so I can make jokes about him, etc., it's even a worse aveira on some level than doing it to an adult. Well, not that it's a worse aveira, but it's harder to get kapara. Because when I do to an adult, I could ask mechila. He could be mochel me. A katan is not a bar mechila. So you leave Yom Kippur with all of the things you do to katanim, like still on your shoulders and the like. So this is what the Basna Rebbe is saying. This is the implication here, that his father did hit him, but his father had to be borrowed to himself that it was not out of anger and frustration. It was out of what was l'tayeles for a child. So there's no question. Parents can do all sorts of things that are l'tayeles. For example, if they ask a teacher, what did my son do today, or whatever it is. You know, so the teacher doesn't have a lashon hara cheshbon. Oh, it's lashon hara for me to tell you. Sorry, I can't tell you. I mean, when people have a need to know in order to be mechanech, they get the information they need to know. And vice versa as well. They can talk to a teacher about different things. So one shouldn't be a fanatic here, because avada for chinuch, the inyanim of chinuch are great, great toelas. And much lashon hara is going to be permitted. But to go beyond that, you know, there is a Bein Adam L'Chavero here that applies to Ketanim as well. Now, okay, be it as it may, Rav Volba actually points out like this. Rav Volba points out that the Gemara in Kedushin says that if a father is makeh b'nai gadol, if a father hits, b'nai gadol means his adult son, the father hits his adult son, the father is oiver on lifnei iver leisitei michshel. Why is that? Because you hit a rebellious teenager, God forbid he might hit you back. If he hits you back, he is over a very severe avera, for which you're chayav misa, if there was a black mumar, makeh aviv v'ima. But look how the Gemara points out. It's an amazing Gemara. The Gemara doesn't point out how bad the kid is. What a rotten kid. He hits his father. He says, you are responsible. You made him do it. Lifnei Iver. You were machshelin by hitting him. Which means a parent has an achrayus not to push a child in such a direction where the child will be over on Kibbutz Aviyim. Now, Rav Olba said, even though the Gemara said it by Bnei Gadol, that was talking about a better door where only a Bnei Gadol would do it. He says, Bisman Azeh, a Bnei Katan is going to do it too. So he actually said that hitting, he felt, again, it depends on the situation, depends on everything, but he says, hitting is not bichlal, the appropriate discipline, Bisman Azeh. And Shlomo HaMelech didn't mean to say, the Pasuk never meant to say b'diyuk, shevet. Shevet doesn't have to mean a literal stick. But it means the discipline, musr, teichach. That's the most important thing. Because there's an achrayas to you. In other words, there's an achrayas on a parent not to be so tough that you're going to cause the child to be a mirate. Because if you cause the child to be a mirate, it's not only the kid's problem. You are over on lifnei iver. So it's really a very amazing statement of Chazal that a parent whose discipline drove the child to behave improperly is considered to be a pagam on the parent, that he was over on lifnei iver in causing the child to be nichshel. So when you read psukim like this, you can't just read it like a Puritan. Right? The Puritans, who very much believed in, you know, real rough physical punishment, you have to look at the whole picture, including Chazal, that Hamakeh b'nai gadol is over on lifnei iver, and the maisa that it has to be l'shem shemayim, otherwise it's considered to be abuse, and the like. Okay. Now, the other thing, though, there's one Gemara that contradicts this, apparently. But you could, again, you could be miyash of it. This is the Gemara in Makkah. Right? The Gemara in Makkah says, he killed somebody b'shogeg, so the halacha is, you go to the Ur Mikvah. Right? I killed somebody accidentally, go to the Ur Mikvah. So the Gemara says, this is only true if you're hitting, you're involved in an activity that's not a mitzvah. I'm cutting wood, and the axe slips, or the blade of the axe flies off. So that's a shogeg. I go to the Ur Mikvah. But what if I killed somebody in the course of my doing a mitzvah? And it gives an example. Ha'av ha'makeh es b'nai. A father is hitting his child. Or a rav, a rebbe, is makeh talmidai. Or a sholiach beistin. So since you killed in the course of doing a mitzvah, the Torah patters you. You're like an honest. Now, sholiach beistin is the easiest thing to understand. That we could fit in. That's referring to a case where before a person gets malchus, a doctor examines a person, and the doctor determines how much can this guy take without dying, because malchus is 39, right? But let's say 39 would kill him, so we have to go to a lower number, and we go to the number that will not kill him that is still divisible by 3. So let's say the person could take 35 malchus. Somehow, I don't know exactly how the medical examination would be so exact, but let's say they say he is capable of taking 35 without dropping dead. Okay. But we can't give him 35 because malchus has to be divisible by 3, because one-third is he's hit in the front and two-thirds on each shoulder in the back. So therefore, if 35 is his maximum, you have to go down to 33, in which case he gets 11 on each shoulder. So, the case of Shliach Beistin is, he is following the number. They said 33. And he gave 33. But the guy died at the 33rd one. So it's not his fault. Now, the Gemara Taka says, if the Shliach Beistin made a mistake, because he wasn't counting right, and instead of 33 he gave more, actually it would have to be more than 35 actually, technically. He gave him 35 or 36. Then the Shliach Beistin is Chayav Golus, because that's negligent. But if he did the number that the Beis Din told him to do, right, so that I understand. That's an honest. All he did was follow the orders of the Beis Din. So there's no avera that he did. Okay, that's fine. But then it gives you the case of a father hitting his son. A father hitting his son, and he kills his son in the course of the hitting, doesn't go to the Ur Mikvah. Now, L'chaira, you might say the following. L'chaira, this seems to contradict Rav Olba's idea and the Gra's idea that if the discipline of a father is supposed to be gentle, if he is hitting his son, what, they take an iron pipe and hits him over the head? I mean, if he's hitting his son in such a way that he kills his son, how could you call that a mitzvah? But the way we'd be matichik is the following. When the Gemara, the case of a father killing a son is not that you're thinking that the father is so brutal that the kid, you know, dies. That wouldn't be a mitzvah. But it means it was like some an accident, meaning to say he might be, he might be running after his son to hold his son and embrace him. And because of this, the son trips and breaks his... You know, in other words, there are ways that a child dies, but it's not a function of the brutality of the discipline. It could be that... it's a little difficult. The case, you have to think about a case, because the case I just gave you, if somebody trips because I'm running after them, I mean, I'm not chayiv at all. That's a grum of a grumma. But let's say, for example, that he's holding his son and he's hitting him gently, but something slips, a blade slips, or a belt buckle slips. In other words, the point I'm making is that the Gemara's case of Av Hamakeh Es Benoi and Hu Adin Arav Hareda Talmidai is not referring to intentional brutality that kills a child, but it's referring to a proper discipline that simply didn't work out well. That's a very different Heichi Timsa, and that would be called a mitzvah. Okay. But be it as it may, the ultimate lesson is that if you love somebody, you give them boundaries. I once heard from a psychologist a very, very interesting mashal that children themselves prefer boundaries. He said that often life is very frightening. So he says life is like you're on a 747 jet plane that's going through the sky. And, you know, you feel that you're not supported. Sometimes a plane is a miracle. Like, you know, why doesn't it fall? Like, why is it in the sky? And things are very, very uncertain. So he says, so imagine that you're sitting and you're a nervous flyer. And, you know, you're trying to, whatever it is, say Tehillim, or you're trying to just relax. And the pilot goes over to you and says, oh, I want to take a break. Would you mind taking over the plane for a little bit? You'd be pretty, it happens sometimes on small planes. These things actually happen. Sometimes, it's a crazy thing, but it happens. The pilot gets a heart attack, and the passenger, and they actually radio the passenger how to land the plane. Very, very frightening. I would recommend don't go on small planes. So, unless there's, okay, whatever. But so the thing is, when a parent, does not give a child any hadracha, it's like telling the child, why don't you just drive the plane? And a child is afraid. It's scary. It's scary. I want to be told what to do. And in fact, even when a kid acts up sometimes, it's a way of getting the parent's attention. Because if the parent kind of says, oh, do what you want, it's fine. The kid wants to be told, no, you can't do it. It gives someone a sense of security. It's very, very interesting. Which reminds me a little bit of a similar maaser at the altar of Slobodka. These were not children anymore. These were B'nai Torah. These were very chashuva people. Now, the altar of Slobodka, he only gave mussar to the people that he felt had great, great potential. When you had potential, he was very tough on you. He would tell you all sorts of things. And sometimes the greatest mussar he would give is when he didn't tell your person anything. In other words, that was the simon that the altar was saying. I said, you came late to Seder, you missed davening. The altar didn't say anything to you. That was the greatest mussar. That meant he held. And he was trying to communicate to you that you're somebody I can't really correct work on right now. And that itself was the biggest desire. So they said there used to be guys who would go over to the altar and say, Rebbe, I missed Seder today. They were hoping that maybe they thought, maybe he didn't know, maybe he didn't notice. He noticed everything. And they were hoping he would give them tochecha. And he said, okay, things happen sometimes. That was like a knife in your heart. It's just, if things happen, you're not good enough to get mussar. And that was the greatest, paradoxically, that was the greatest mussar of all. When he would just tell somebody, okay, it's fine, you missed Seder, okay. So that's the idea, that when you care about somebody, you want to actively try to correct them and the like. Okay. Now we have the last pasuk that says, Tzadik eichel l'seiva nafshei. A tzadik eats to satisfy his soul. Beten Rishayim, but the stomach of the Rasha, Techsar, will always be lacking. So again, the simple idea is that in Tzaddik, the word nefesh, right? We actually, in Kabbalah, we talk about many different types of souls. Nefesh is the normal term that we use for the nefesh ha-bahamis, the animal soul. And a tzaddik eats, right? We're not supposed to fast. What does the Gemara tell us? The Gemara tells us that if a person is yayshay betainus, except in days like today, of course, but if you simply take on extra days of fasting, we paskin. Again, sometimes you do a tainus chalayim, but just if part of your avodah you'd want to take on extra fasting, it would be discouraged. Chazal have a lesson, it's a chayte, right? Some say chayte is lavdafka, but for most of us, it would be actively discouraged. Because we have to eat. If we don't eat, we can't concentrate, we don't learn well. So what are you gaining? You're gaining a tainus at the expense of learning, at the expense of tefillah. But tefillah and learning are bigger mitzvahs, generally speaking. So we say you have to eat, you have to take care of yourself, you have to take care of your body, you have to get the right amount of sleep. This is what the Chafetz Chaim said is the meaning of Ma'ariv, a very famous word of the Chafetz Chaim. Every Ma'ariv davening, we say, V'haser Satan, remove the Satan, milfaneinu, from in front of me, in front of us, umi'achareinu, and from in back of me. So the Satan in front of us is, I want to do a mitzvah, and this Yetzer Hara is trying to stop me by giving different ideas in my head. Right? So that's the Satan that's blocking the door to the Beis HaMedrash. But what is the Satan in back of me? I'm already past him. Right? What can he do to me? He said, Chafetz Chaim said, the Satan in back of you is the Satan that's pushing you into the Beis HaMedrash. What type of Satan is pushing me into the Beis HaMedrash? That's a good Satan. I'd like to have that Satan. That's the Satan that says, skip breakfast, don't eat. Don't go to sleep. Don't leave the Beis HaMedrash. Stay in the Beis HaMedrash till 4 o'clock in the morning, 5 o'clock in the morning. Learn. Shteig, that's your avodah. But why is that the Ma'aseh Yetzer Hara? Because the Yetzer Hara looks at the long-term effect of things. The short-term, you're shteigin, you're learning, great, wonderful. What's going to happen is your health is going to collapse, you're not going to be able to learn, not going to be able to daven. So the Yetzer Hara is going to be happy. So the Chafetz Chaim says, it's a shame that there's a Yetzer Hara that tries to stop you from doing mitzvahs. There's a certain Yetzirah that wants you to do mitzvahs in a way that you ignore your physical health. And by ignoring your physical health, ultimately, that Yetzirah is going to have a nitzachon over you. Because in the short term, maybe you think you're growing and growing and growing. In the long term, everything is going to collapse. And b'chlal, in avodah Hashem, applies to a lot of things as well. When a person who is a Baal Tshuva wants to take on all sorts of things right away, that's also a Ma'aseh Yetzirah. You have to do things gradually, slowly, solidly, and the like. Right? So that's the Yetzer Hara that tries to tell me to disregard the body. By the way, the Chafetz Chaim literally experienced this. We don't know exactly, but when he was, I believe, a teenager, maybe early 20s, but maybe even as a teenager, he was not able to learn for an entire year. He was ill, and he only learned either Chumash, I think Tanakh. He did not learn anything that required Ian. And you can imagine how difficult that was for him and how tragic it was for him. But he said for his, but he realized that he had been pushing himself so much that essentially there was kind of a physical breakdown that required that he keep away. So that is, I think, I have a feeling that that is why he was so makbid on this issue. He used to come into the Beis Medrash in Radin, 1 o'clock in the morning, shut off the lights, kick people out, all of these inyanim. I think because he knew himself that the toll that it took on him when he had pushed himself to a level which was not proper. Now again, sometimes you have people like the Vilna Gaon. The Vilna Gaon was able to sleep 2 hours a night and live on a kazayas of bread. Okay, it depends on a person's strength. Some people physically have a constitution. In fact, the Vilna Gaon was blessed, actually, it is recorded, as a very, very healthy constitution. It's very interesting that he was heavy set, even though he never ate anything, never slept. Ruddy complexion. We actually have descriptions of physical. You know, he looked like a longshoreman type of person. And they say the Torah itself gave him his mezainus. But that was a very, very unusual madrega. That's not a madrega. If somebody were to say, I want to be like the Vilna Gaon and learn 22 hours a day and only sleep in 4 half-hour segments, we would say we would not allow you to do that, right? If you learn 15 hours a day, it'll be good. You'll be good. And the like. So a person has to know. So this is what it says here: a tzaddik eats to satisfy the soul. A tzaddik realizes, I have to take care of my body, because the body is the kli which enables the neshama to be payel. The yikar mitzvahs of a person is their neshama. But without a guf, you can't do mitzvahs. You can't learn Torah in this world. And the only thing you'll get in Olam Haba is what you do in this world in Olam Hazeh. So memela, the tzaddik eats l'soiva nafshei. But that is because his eating, and this is a symbol for all physical pleasures, eating, sleeping, exercising, whatever it is all for the purpose of the nefesh, meaning here the Gra says, it means the spiritual neshama. The tzaddik eats so that the nefesh will do what it needs to do. This is not interpreting nefesh as nefesh behema, but nefesh is the divine soul. But the Rasha, who engages in physical pleasure for its own sake, not as a means to the ends, will never feel satisfied. Because when you eat in order to learn, so as soon as you have enough that you can learn, so you're happy. But when you eat because that's the end of life, then you'll always want more. So therefore, the stomach of the Rasha will always feel empty. Now, that doesn't mean necessarily eating-wise, I mean, you know, you might feel full, but it means that there'll always be a taiva for more and more. When your taiva is an emtsoi for ruchnias, so at the point that it's satisfied, you'll go on to the ruchnias. But when it's an end in and of itself, there'll always be a hargasha of a chisorin. Okay? And that's the difference between means for an end and looking at the gashmias as the end of life, the purpose of life. They tell that a chassid once asked the Rebbe, in a bit of an irreverent way, he says, why is the Rebbe different than me? I take a banana, I make a bracha. The Rebbe takes a banana, he takes a bracha. What exactly is the difference? So the Rebbe said, I'll tell you the difference. The difference is, there are many times a day that I have an uncontrollable taiva to praise Hashem. I want to praise Hashem. I want to say a bracha to Hashem. But Nebuch. There's a din of bracha levatala. I can't just Baruch atah Hashem, I can't just say a bracha. So I look around for something that it'll give me an excuse to say a bracha. So I see the banana. Ah, now I can make a bracha. He says, my taiva is to praise the Almighty. I need the banana to praise the Almighty. He says, with you, he says, Musar, with you, it's the opposite. You get hungry many times a day. You gotta eat a banana, want an apple, you know, got low blood sugar, whatever it is. So I look around for the banana to eat, and then the mela, I gotta make a bracha. So the question is your motivator the banana? Are you making the bracha because you want to eat the banana? Or are you eating the banana because you want to make the bracha? He says, that's the nafkamina. He says, are you eating for the neshama? Are you eating for the guf? They tell him last year, the brisker rav, used to go to Switzerland all the time. Why did he go to Switzerland? The Vishkov had, unfortunately, asthma. And the air quality in Yerushalayim is not very good for that, especially you have a lot of construction, even back then in the 40s and 50s, and there's a lot of particles in the air and the like. So he used to go to Switzerland a lot, and he had a relative, he had a nephew, Rav Chaim's older brother, who was not a Rosh Hashiva, Zohar Gershon, a very big tzaddik. He had children who lived in Switzerland, Rav Moshe Soloveitcher, who became a Rosh Hashiva, actually. And so he used to go all the time. There are many, many pictures of the Brisker Rav in Switzerland. So there was a hotel. Switzerland has, even to this day, has a Haredi, mainly Hasidish population. So he used to stay at a certain hotel, Yerushalayim. And the people in the hotel were always, they always wanted to know, could they do something special for him? Could they make special food for him? But he never wanted anything. He didn't want it. He just wanted a bed. He wanted bread. And they felt very, very bad that they never had an opportunity to bring him something. So one day he goes over to the woman who runs the hotel. It was a Yerushalayim, a firm woman. He says, on Shabbos afternoon, he says, can I trouble you to bring me an apple and a tomato? And she was so overjoyed. Oh, Baruch Hashem, bring the brisker up an apple and a tomato. And, she has her husband bring it over to him. And he says, thank you very much. I don't need it. Thank you. So, my, you know, what was his habimina? What was the maskana? It turned out like this. It turned out that the Brisker Rav was making a cheshbon of Meya Brachas. You know, Shabbos, you know, he's supposed to recite 100 Brachas every day. And Shabbos, you have a big problem, right? Because a regular Shemone Esrei has 19 Brachos, right? And so already with Shemone Esrei, starting from the Maariv of the night before, 19 times 3, that already gives you 57 Brachos. So 57 out of the 100 you already have with Shemone Esrei. Now, a Shabbos Shemone Esrei is only 7 Brachos, although you have 4 Shemone Esreis, because you have Musaf, so you have 28. So Shabbos, there's a problem, right? Shabbos, you got to figure out how to make up 100 Brachos, because instead of 57 Shemone Esrei Brachos, you only have 28, right? So basically, you eat extra, you know, whatever it would be. So the Brisker Rav made a cheshbon that he was missing 2 Brachos with everything that he added. So he wanted to make ha'etz on the apple and ha'adama on the tomato. Now, why Borei Nefashos wouldn't get made? So maybe he was missing 3, or maybe some say Borei Nefashos may not count because it's not a bracha that's a chayva. Okay, it's not clear. Maybe he was missing 3. I don't remember the details of the story. What happened was, no, the chayva was missing 2, I think, because the rise from the terrace. What happened was that by Mincha, Shabbos Mincha, he was called up to be Levi. So when you're called up for an aliyah, you have 2 brachos. So he made up his 2 brachos by the aliyah l'Torah, so he didn't need the banana and the tomato, or the apple and the tomato. The apple and the tomato. Banana tomato would not be, but an apple and tomato. Because he said, I only wanted it for the mea brachos. I have the mea brachos. Yeah, why don't you come bring the fleshes? Okay. I mean, if he only needed 2 brachos, then a single fruit would have given him 2 brachas. I don't know why in the Maisa, you have to be medayik in the Maisa, why the 2 brachas had to be brachas rishona. I mean, why wouldn't the bracha achrona count?
Maybe he wouldn't want to eat a shear.
That's a good point. That's a good point. Maybe he didn't want to eat a shear. He literally just wanted to be, I'd say, a bracha.
The problem with a tomato.
Yeah. That's it. Although, to say that he would be mitzam tamad kedei kach, it's shayach, but I think that maybe that's a little too much even for the Brisker Rav, perhaps. I'm not eating a kezayas because of this. It reminds me of another maisa, nothing to do with this at all, but it's a very interesting halachic maisa, that one of the Brisker Rav's children once went over to him. It was Shabbos Rosh Chodesh. And he said he felt very bad. He says he davened Shmona Esrei without saying Yalavi Avay. So he asked to daven Mincha again. So he felt bad. He says he was negligent. He wasn't thinking. So the Brisker Rav says, no, there's a halba nechama, half of a nechama, because this way you have extra brachos. You have 4 extra brachos, 7 extra brachos towards your cheshmon of Meya brachos, because you have an extra Shmona Esrei. So this is actually very nagar b'halacha, because the Brisker Rav was apparently saying that the erroneous Shmona Esrei, which did not have Yalav Yavam, that you have to repeat again, still counts as a Shmona Esrei legabe the cheshmon of Meya Brachos. That's a very interesting psak halacha, and that might be totally on different rishayim. Meaning, we don't look at, in other words, we don't say a Shmona Esrei without Yalav Yavam is a 0. We say it's a Shmona Esrei that's missing Yalav Yavam, but it's still a Shmona Esrei. See, let me give you, again, forgive me for digressing a little bit on Dvar Halacha. Let me give you a practical nafkamina. This is the chakir. Is a Shmona Esrei without Yalav Yavai a 0? Or is it a Shmona Esrei without Yalav Yavai, which I have to repeat because I need a Shmona Esrei with Yalav Yavai, but I still have a Shmona Esrei? So one nafkamina would be, is the defective Shmona Esrei count towards Meya Brachos? Okay, that's a bit the Yevit. But there's another nafkamina, and this is very nogea. Let's say that Rosh Chodesh is Shabbos, but Sunday, Motzei Shabbos, is not Rosh Chodesh. Now, if I would have skipped Mincha and Shabbos Lagamri, I would have to recite 2 Maarivs. And now, what Maarivs would they be? They both would be weekday Maarivs, because you don't recite, even though you're making up for Shabbos, but now that it's weekday, you do weekday. So what if, instead of not doing Mincha at all, what if I did Mincha, but I didn't do Yalav Yavam? Now, if I remember before nightfall, I do another mincha. But if I don't remember till after nightfall, is there a reason to do two maariv? Now, so this depends. If you learn that a mincha without yalav yavo is ki'ilu, you didn't daven at all, so I'm going to do two maariv. I didn't daven mincha. I got to do two maariv. But if you learn you did daven a shmona esrei, but your only problem is you didn't say one with yalav yavo, what are you going to gain by making it up for Mayer if you're not going to say Yalo Viago anyway? So B'chiyai Gavna, many poskim say, you would not daven two Mayeres because you're doing no better than what you already did. I already davened Shimon Esri without Yalo Viago, so I should do that again? But if you learn it's a zero, then you would. So, since the Brisker Rav, just working backwards, since the Brisker Rav is saying that a Shimon Esri without Yalo Viago is still the Shimon Esri, then the only thing you're missing is the Shmona Esrei with the Yalav Yavo. The logic of that psak would indicate you would not repeat and Ma'ariv.
Yeah. Could it maybe be that he holds the brachos are brachos, but it's not a chovas Shmona Esrei, so still you would have.
That is possible. That brachos does not require that they have a shame Shmona Esrei. That might be possible as well. Although, once again, would a brachal of Atala count as Mayor Brachas? I mean, probably not, right? I mean, a person made brachal of Atala.
Well, brachos in the Shikha, if it would.
It might become a brachal of Atala. If it's not, if you're not yet Yeshua and Ezra, it might be a brachal of Atala, right? I mean, a brachal of Atala knowledge. So that might be a kasha. I don't know what you're saying in that way. Okay. How did I get onto this? This was a maisa. I got the other maisa. But the maisa of the tomato and the apple, that is an important maisa. That connects to this pasuk directly. That the tzaddik sees Gashmias as a tool in his Avodas Hashem. The Rasha sees Gashmias as an end in and of itself. As a result, the Tzaddik will be satisfied with the Gashmias he has in this world. The Rasha will not. The Rasha will always want more and more and more. And that's why it says the Betin of the Rasha will always be missing. He will never be full or never be fully satisfied.
Could this be related to the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, Izehu Ashira, Sameach Bechelka?
Yeah, it is very much connected, that Ashiras is when you're happy with what you have. It's interesting, you mentioned that Mishnah, right? Pirkei Avos says, Izehu Ashir, what is Ashiras? Sameach Bechelka, he was happy with his lot. So here's the question I want to ask you. That certainly applies to Gashmias. My Avaida in Gashmias is I should be happy with what the Avishter gave me. I shouldn't want more. I shouldn't desire more. I should be besimcha with what Hashem gave me. In Gashmias, it absolutely is the case. Here's the question I want to raise. Should a person be sameach b'chelko in Ruchnias? Right? Should I be happy spiritually with what I have? So here, there's a certain subtlety. In some ways, yes, and in some ways, absolutely not. If you mean by Sameach B'chelko, I'm happy, I learn an hour a day, I do this and that, I'm happy, I did Rashi, I don't have to do Taisus. That's not proper. A Yid has to try to say, I want to become better, I want to grow, I want to go further in my Torah understanding. So to be a Sameach B'chelko in terms of being complacent and not wanting to grow, that's a very bad thing. Right, Sameach Bechelko is for Gashmias. When you have money in the bank, then you say, I don't need more money. But to say, I don't need more Torah, there's no Indian of being Sameach Bechelko. But in a deeper level, there actually is a Sameach Bechelko in the sense that a person has to look at his kochos and his talents and rejoice in them and be happy instead of looking at somebody else and saying, oh, if I only was like him or only had his abilities and his, then I could grow in Avodas Hashem. But Nebuch, I don't have the ability, I don't have the talent. There we say you have to be Sameach. You have to know that within the kochos that Hashem gave you, and your kochos might be different. It's not that every person could be the same. It's not that you could do the same thing he's doing. Maybe you can't do the same thing he's doing. But that's not your job in life. Your job is not to do the same thing he's doing. Your job is to do what you're able to do. And there's plenty there. There's plenty there. So in that sense, your sameach in the chelek Hashem gave you But then you develop it in the best way that you can. Now that takes a lot of work and thought. Right? Take your chelek and cultivate it. So don't be sameach in the sense of I'll just let it be whatever it is. But you work within your chelek. What do they say? They say with tomatoes, again, another tomato mushroom. They say the job of a tomato is not to become a pineapple, but to become the best tomato it can be. A pineapple is bigger, whatever it is. Right? This is the famous statement of Rav Zusha. The Eibishter is not going to ask me, why wasn't I Avraham Avinu? Why wasn't I Moshe? I have a good teretz for that. But he's going to ask me, why wasn't I Zusha? Why wasn't I what I could be? That, he says, I don't know if I have a teretz for. Okay, that's the only question. So, on a deep level, there is an idea of Sameach Bechelkai in being Makir, the Kedusha of your Makam and your Madrega and your ability, and then try to develop it in the best way that you can. Okay. So now, we go to the next Perek. I'll just do one or two Pesukim. And the first Pasuk is, it does raise a grammatical problem. It says, Chachmos Nashim Bansa Besa Chachmos. First of all, it's not even clear how you translate Chachmos. Is Chachmos Nashim the wisdoms? First of all, it is a plural word. Does it mean the wisdoms of women? Of women build her house? Or does it mean wise women? Is Chachmos Nashim the wisdom of women? Or is Chachmos Nashim wise women? Now, grammatically, the plural, just like a Chacham is a singular and Chachama is a female, Chachamim is plural male, Chachamos is the plural for a lot of wise women. So technically, if it would have meant wise women, it would have said Chachamos Nashim, or Nashim Chachamos. Chochmos is not the plural of Chachama, it is the plural of Chochma. Chochma is wisdom. Chochmos is wisdoms. Now, this is very unusual. It is very unusual in Tanakh, or in Chazal for that matter, for the word wisdom to be pluralized. How many times have you seen the word chachmos? It's always chachma. Okay, but you see grammatically at this point? Chachma is wisdom. Chachama is a woman, wise person. Chachma is wisdom, and chacham is a man, right? So the plural of chachama is chachamos. Okay? Chachmos is the plural of chachma. So one question here is, just looking at the pasuk, why do we pluralize chachmos? And the second question is, if we do pluralize it, why do we use a singular verb? Chachmos nashim bansa. Besa. Now, besa is not a problem, because besa could be going back on the house of a woman. It could say, the wisdoms of many women built her house. Her could be, you know, any individual woman. But bansa is a problem. Right? Because bansa is a singular verb, and here you have a plural noun. Okay, we'll come back to that. But why it's pluralized, I think there's an important idea here that's communicating. First of all, this pasuk, Lefi Pshuto, the Gra will give us another pshat, is referring to the role of a woman in creating a bias, just like the Eishes Chayil. And it recognizes that a family, a home, is largely created by the woman of the house. You know, the men might study the Torah, they might do more of the mitzvos, but the emotional harmony that allows everybody to function is really because of the woman. And Chazal say this many, many times. And first of all, I mean, Mishle, the whole parak Eishes Chayil, even though we have all sorts of drushas that it's going on the Torah, yes, that's all true. But Ein Mikra Yosei L'dei Pshut, it's also going on your wife. Meaning to say, don't think that all of these drushas do not replace the simple meaning of that pasuk. Ein mikra yotze midei pshuta. And the Medrash tells us that It was a man and a woman. They were both tzaddikim. They were both righteous people. And for whatever reason, they didn't have children after many years. So for Pru or Vu, it was decided that they would get divorced so the man could find another wife with whom he could have children. The Rama says we don't do that today, but nevertheless, this was practiced. So the man found another wife who happened to be not a righteous woman. And the woman found a shidduch with a man who was not a righteous man. Nebuch, the second marriages were not good here. The man married a non-religious woman, and the woman married a non-religious man. At first glance, you would think this is a double tragedy. Maybe triple tragedy, the tragedy of breaking up the marriage, and then each one got into a shidduch of a non-religious person. How that happened, I have no idea, but it happened. The Medrash goes on and says, the religious woman made the non-religious man from Shomer Mitzvahs, a Talmud Chacham, a studier of Torah. And Nebuch, the non-religious woman, made the religious man not religious, and left the way of Hashem. And Chazal say, Hakol Mino Isha. And that is what this pasuk is saying in a very literal way. It is the wisdom of the woman that creates the home, the aveles, and a foolish woman, a woman who is not living by those standards, biyadeha tarasenu, with her own hands, she will rip down the house. And that doesn't have to mean literally ripping down a physical house, but a house of kedusha. The woman will make it, the woman will destroy it. Okay? And that's exactly what the Medrash says. The non-religious woman destroyed her husband. The religious woman brought her husband up. Now, that doesn't mean deliberately from girls should decide, I want to marry a non-religious person. It doesn't always work. We have Yetzer Hara, and women can get dragged down as well. But some Svarim say that this was the Tainan Yaakov Avinu. Remember the story Rashi brings that the reason why Dina was raped by Shechem was because Yaakov was being punished because Esav wanted to marry Dina, and Yaakov kept her in a box, which means he kept her away, so she would have no connection to Esav. So people say, what, there's a taina on Yaakov? Yaakov should have let her marry Esav? You're going to let your daughter marry a Russia? So some say that, yeah, in this case it could have worked. Dina was such a tzaddikess that she could have changed Esav. And Yaakov should have known that. Again, it's still very hard to understand from a human level. And Yaakov deprived Esav of the chance that he could have been turned around by a righteous woman. And I will tell you this, you know, I've been involved, unfortunately, with many, many cases of intermarriage. It comes up. It's Ein Bayis, Asher Ein Sham Meis. Families, intermarriage all over the place. The statistic I used to use, somebody told me it's incorrect now, is 1 out of 2 marriages in which one of them is a Jew is to a guy. 1 out of 2. Somebody told me that a recent study says if you exclude Orthodox people from the population and you only look at non-Orthodox Jews, it is 7 out of 10 are intermarriages. Yeah, the reason it's 1 out of 2 is because you're including from people who don't intermarry, so the whole average becomes 1 out of 2. Take out from people, 7 out of 10. But the truth is, unfortunately, even in religious families, I mean, it's low, Baruch Hashem, but there is intermarriage in religious families, meaning children of religious families are intermarrying, marrying goyim. They go to college, whatever it is. But I will tell you this, when a Jewish man marries a non-Jewish woman, there is actually greater potential, because what often happens is the non-Jewish woman wanted to be mizdabek. She was interested in Judaism. So she will be the force that can make her husband from. The Jewish man who marries out, or the Jewish is against Judaism, right? So if the Jewish woman is marrying out, marries a guy, there'll be nothing. In other words, the woman is the mashpia. I know a case, friends of mine, this is I'm going to digress for a moment because halachically it's a fascinating case, where this man was raised as a Kohen, totally secular. He marries a guy. Marries a guy, not a ger, a guy. He has 4 children from this guy. She starts exploring Judaism more and more. She wants to be frum. She starts keeping Shabbos, kashrus, taras and mishpacha. She wants a geris kahalacha. But do you see what the problem here is? Problem is, intermarriage is forbidden anyway, but in order for her to have a geirus, she has to accept upon herself the mitzvos. One of the mitzvos is a kohen is not allowed to marry a geiros. So the Beis Din was very in a big mavuch, and they said, we're going to have to talk to Rav Moshe Feinstein about this, but they wanted it. But they wanted her to know that, do you realize that there is a chance, if we accept your conversion, you will have to leave your husband? Are you willing to accept the Torah to such a degree that if the halacha says you must leave your husband, you will do so? So they called her in separately, and she broke down crying, and she said, if this is the will of Hashem, I accept it. It will be a tragedy for me. It will be the hardest thing I ever did. But if this is Hashem's will, this is what I will do. They called the husband in, who was much less religious. He was not into all this. And they said, he wanted a conversion because he wanted his wife to be Jewish, so everybody would accept it. But mitzvahs were not his big issue. And they said, do you realize if we convert your wife, there may be a chance you'll have to get divorced? So he looked at the base then. He said, you guys are idiots. You guys are crazy. And he walked out. So he was not willing to live with it. She was. They went to Rav Moshe, because they didn't know, the Beis Din in Chicago did not want to pass it. They wanted to go to Gadol Hador. And they went to Rav Moshe, and Rav Moshe gave an amazing psak, very, very helpful psak in many ways. Rav Moshe said, how do you know you're a Kohen? Your father told you you're a Kohen? My father told me I was a Kohen. Your father Shomer Shabbos? He says, no. You have any Shomer Shabbos relatives? No. He says, well, technically, your mishpacha has no nemanus, and if we are mesupik, if you're a kohen or not a kohen, we follow the rule of majority. Anyone that separates from a group comes from the majority of the group. If the majority of Jews are not kohanim, halachically you're not a kohen. Now, Rav Moshe emphasized that this was a psak b'shas hadchak, when people were already married, they already have children. But this Rav Moshe's psak was that he is allowed to regard himself as not a kohen, therefore he could stay married to his wife. So these are very, very close friends. So the person tells me that he's a little afraid of the coming of Mashiach, because Mashiach is going to be Mavara, all of the issues of Yichud. So maybe he'll discover he is a kohen, he's not allowed to stay married to his wife, and he's afraid. So I told him that a Kadosh Baruch Hu somehow will change the reality for Moshe Paskin, not a Kohen. Somehow, somewhere, this is what's going to be. A Kadosh Baruch Hu would not allow there to be a michshol in his psak. But what's interesting is that his father is not alive anymore. His father is not religious, but his father knows about Kohens. So his father still gets the aliyah of Kohen when he visits. And Duchens, I think, and the son doesn't. Yeah, whatever, different in Yonim. One is a Kohen. None of them are Kohanim. But based on this, you should know, though, this was a well-known psak, and countless, one of the big Shiduchim problems for Bali Tshuva is a Bali Tshuva that's a Kohen has a difficult issue of marriage. Why is that so? A Kohen doesn't have to marry a virgin, but a Kohen cannot marry a woman that had relations with a guy. Once there was relations with a guy. So here, if you have a Baal Tshuva, a Kohen, who's in his 30s, let's say, an older Baal Tshuva, 30s, and he wants to marry a woman of comparable age, who's a Balas Tshuva, unfortunately in our day and age, people have histories, which might make them puzzle for a Kohen. So older Kohanim have difficulty finding Shiduchim that are muteris, the Kohuna Bismanazah. So people are calling up the Beis Din saying, well, maybe I'm not a Kohen. They're actually trying not to be a Kohen. I don't have any religious shelters. They're actually... So I got a call from a Dayan in America. He says, I'm very offended. He says, I'm a Kohen, and I'm proud of it, and it's a big success that we were given the Kedusha of Ara. And all I get, all day, I get people calling up, can you find a way that I'm not a Kohen? He says, what type of zilzal I'm Kohen? But this is true. This is indeed a crisis situation to some degree. But the bottom line, that I'm bringing up this mice just to illustrate this very important idea, that the woman really is, this phrase, akeres habayis, By the way, it's interesting how the drash and the pshat are so different. The phrase "Mayshivi akeres habayis aim habanim smecha." That's a verse on Halal. Tehillim. The translation of akeres habayis means the barren one, the woman without children. It's talking about Hashem will take the barren woman without children and make her the mother of happy, the happy mother of children. So akeres in that pasuk means barren, sterile. But Chazal's drush is very different. That akeres does not come from sterile or barren, it comes from ikar, foundation. So the way we use the term today, when we talk about a wife, as akeres habayis, we're not referring to being barren, we're going with the drash, but it's so interesting that the pshat and the drash are mamish opposite translations of the phrase. But this is not just like a homily that you say at a Sheva Brachas or whatever it is. I mean, it is 100% true that the bias, the home, is the engine. It is the makor of the kedusha that a person has in his life. And that kedusha comes from the relationship with his wife, in particular, the wife's own shivos, that if she is a spiritual person, if she is one that is an Eved Hashem, one that creates in the house a certain atmosphere of kedusha, that's going to affect the children, that's going to affect the husband, that's going to change everything in the house. It's much more difficult for the husband to do it on his own if the wife is not in the same place. Again, the Medrash says, the wife's hashpa on her husband is much greater than the hashpa of a husband on a wife. That's not to say it doesn't exist. Hashpahs exist in both directions, to be sure. But the dominant hashpah is going to be your wife. Because if nothing else, if your wife gets hana when you learn, you're going to want to learn more. If she doesn't get hana, you're going to feel less... No. Baruch Hashem, some of you are still single, so right now you just worry about yourself. That's good. But once there's that dynamic, which is the ultimate goal that Hashem wants us to have, the woman is going to be the tremendous empower, right? She will make you or break you in that way. So one needs to be very careful that they make the right choice in these matters. That's what it says. The aveles biyadeh tarsenu. She'll rip up the house with her own hands. That's actually the phrase. Now, having said this, and again, I do want to emphasize the klal of Chazal, ein mikra yetzi b'dei pshuto, is a very important rule. So even though the Gemara is going to give us other pshatim, it does not replace the simple pshat. The simple pshat is emes, and 100% true. But the Gemara goes on and says allegorically, there are other layers of understanding of this pasuk. And he points out that nashim is often a reference to the neshama. The neshama is often referred to, in fact, the word neshama itself is feminine. And the neshama, in fact, is called Eisha Shefas Tor, a beautiful woman. That's how the neshama is described. And then he says the following. He says that we have more than that, but there are two phrases that are often used for a house. One is a bayis, and one is a naveh. Naveh is a dwelling place. The difference between bayis and naveh is bayis is your permanent home, and a naveh is your temporary home. So if I go to your house for Shabbos, your house is my naveh, but it's not my bayis. So he says, a tzaddik regards his real home as Olam Haba. This world is a naveh, a temporary dwelling. The Russia looks at this world as a bias. So he says the following. The wisdom of an Isha, which is the wisdom of a soul, when you allow your soul to control your life, then all of your decisions are towards building your ultimate home. Your ultimate bias is Olam Haba. Meaning, you make your decisions. It's really kind of connected to the pasuk before. You make your decisions not based on how comfortable the naveh is, but how strong your bias is. And your bias is your Olam Haba. The tzaddik decides his life based on Olam Haba, and the avelis will destroy that bias in favor of the temporary dwelling of Olam Hazeh, right? That's how the Gemara understands it, that the aveles And in a way, it's not even a Russia. Avelis means a foolish person. Because the Gras says, it's not that people want to be Rishayim, but they're foolish in the sense of just not looking at what is important in life. In other words, it's something to be pitied. The car that you have, how big your house is, but that's another. You know, they tell the story of the Chafetz Chaim. Again, it's a famous, these are famous little stories. Where, you know, the Chafetz Chaim was beforesome, even among Gedolim, to have an extremely simple, bare-bones place. You know, he lived in a kind of a big, it was a big house, big, but it was just like one room, big room, dirt floor. There was no floor, just dirt. Almost no furniture, a few rickety, broken chairs, a broken table. That's all he had. So somebody said to the Chafetz Chaim, a visitor, said, Rebbe, why don't you have more furniture? Why don't you have more things? Why are you so threadbare? Where's your furniture? So the Chafetz Chaim said to him, I can ask you the same question. Where's your furniture? He says, I don't live here. I'm just passing through. Chafetz Chaim says, me too. You don't have furniture, you're traveling. Right? You take furniture when you're traveling? No, he says, I'm traveling through. My ultimate destination is Olam Haba. What did Chazal say? That this world is like a prose door, a hallway. Olam Haba is the trackline, is the palace. Haskein Atzmacha, the prose door. Prepare yourself in the hallway so that when you enter the palace, you look respectable. That's exactly it. So that's how the Gra translates it. Chachmos Nashim. The wisdom of the soul, the Isha is the soul, Bansa Besa, she puts all of her efforts into building the house, Olam Haba. The foolish person destroys their house in favor of the temporary dwelling of Naveh because they think the temporary dwelling is what matters. You know, they give a mashal. I don't know who gives this mashal, but obviously it's a modern mashal about a person who was an obsessive compulsive individual, and he was taking his first trip to Israel, and he wanted to be fully prepared for the trip. But in those days, they didn't have direct flights. They would have stopovers in Paris or some other place. So there was going to be an 8-hour stopover in France, and because he was so obsessive compulsive, he spent the whole year learning French so that for those 8 hours, he would be able to speak French. And you know, so he worked the whole year to learn French, and the plane stops, and Baruch Hashem, he's able to order a Coca-Cola in French. Then he realizes he was so involved in the stopover Hachana, he didn't do anything about the ultimate destination. Now they say that, I mean, this is maybe a trivial case, but they say that in some ways this is a mashal for Olam Hazeh. We have a stopover. We hope the stopover will be 120 years in good health. Be a good stopover. And stopover, there are a lot of stopover skills that you need. You need to know, you know, how to make a living. You need to know where the cleaners are. You need to know. There are stopover skills. But we invest so much effort sometimes in the stopover skills that we neglect when it's time after 120 years for the ultimate destination. What do we bring with us, you see? So he says, you got to be very careful. You need to devote some time to the stopover skills. I'm going to be in Paris for 8 hours. You know, I may need to know how to do something. I have to know where the bathroom is, right? At least I have to know something. But don't put all your efforts in that. Because then what are you going to come to Olam Haba with? So that's the idea, that the woman destroys her bias. There's a whole bias that could have been waiting there. But it got destroyed because no materials were brought to it. See, this is a bias that needs a constant influx of energy. The Torah, the mitzvahs, is building that bias. You don't do that, the bias falls apart. It's not there. And then you show up after 120 years. Nothing's there. You're living in or you're living in a shack. So we have that capacity. So that's how the Gra interprets it. He then gives another pshat, yet another pshat. So according to this pshat, Besa refers to Olam Haba. But now he gives a third pshat. It's very fascinating. Right? So one pshat is, it's the role of women. The Gra doesn't say that, actually, but that's the first thing, that the woman creates the home. The second pshat is that bias is Olam Haba, and everything that Tzaddik does is designed to build that bias in Olam Haba. But then the Gras has a third pshat, which is actually very fascinating. He says, the bias might mean your own body. Might mean your own body. The wise soul builds its bias. Now, protects its body. Now, if that's what it would mean, that would just be literally the same thing as the other pasuk, but it means a little different. Here's what the Gras says. Metaphysically, this is going to be a different thought, but bias is referring to the body. And he says the following. He says, Tzaddikim and Rishayim both have mitzvos and averus. Even Rishayim, most Rishayim have some mitzvos. And Hashem is going to definitely reward Rishayim for their mitzvos. And conversely, Hashem is going to punish Tzaddikim for their averus. So other than quantity, more or less, l'chaira, the din of the tzaddik and the rasha is fundamentally exactly the same. I don't mean it'll be the same in degree, but it's the same cheshbon. You get rewarded for the good that you do, and you get punished for the bad that you do. It happens to be a rasha has more bad than good, a tzaddik has more good than bad, but ultimately there's going to be a schar v'onesh on good and evil. The mitzvahs don't disappear, and the averus don't disappear. But the Gras says there is a difference. Now, it's not sure why to us this would be meaningful. He says that the tzaddik, who most of his life is serving Hashem, when he enters Olam Haba after Gehenna, even the guf enters Olam Haba. And even the guf, because the tzaddik did not give in to the Yetzer Hara, so the guf itself became purified. And therefore the guf participates in schar. The rasha, the neshama will be salvaged for the good that he did, but the guf will certainly be destroyed. So he says, the wisdom of the righteous person builds up the body, meaning even the body comes to Olam Haba, but the avelis, that's a rasha, the body gets destroyed. Now, the truth is, in our madrega, I'm not sure I understand why that would be so significant, meaning, if the body comes or not comes, as long as my neshama comes. But apparently it is a different hargash of schar, in which the tzaddik has a sense of completion. His wholeness is in Olam Haba. The rasha, even when he's eventually zaycha to Olam Haba, and a rasha is eventually zaycha, unless he's a kaifer. The Rambam says beferish, even a rasha that's ruva avonos, will go to Olam Haba. But when he goes, there will always be a sense that it's not my whole being. He'll be in Olam Haba, but there's a sense of something was left behind. And apparently there's a certain measure of tsar in that. So that's how the Gra learns. A third pshat, Chachmas Nashim, the wisdom of the soul, builds up the body, meaning even the body gets admission in Olam Haba, but the Avelis destroys the body, because even though there's going to be sechar for her mitzvahs, it'll only be a schar in Olam for the neshama, and not for the guf. Again, though, you have to see. I mean, this is a little schwer, because certainly, at least the way the Rambam describes Olam Haba, there is no makom for a guf at all in Olam Haba. Olam Haba is kula ruchni. So this statement that somehow the guf is also nichnas and Olam Haba, you have to see if it fits, if it's recommended. Maybe it's not. I mean, the Gra is not meshubit to follow the Rambam. But at least the way the Rambam describes Olam Haba, that does not fit. But he does say, so there are things here. Again, the ideas that are stated here are not always fully developed. You know, they're said to kitzer and they're thrown out as ideas in a sentence or a line or two. But one has to see, Taka, if the Rambam would agree with this statement. It could be that it's not shayach to learn that way. Okay, maybe we'll stop here and the rest of the time.
Once next,
So this Moshe Shabbos, there probably will not be a shayach. I have to be in Sfat, although theoretically I might get back early, but I think it's safer to assume there's no shift. The week after, is Benos Nani. So I'm here, I'm willing, but if most people aren't going to be here or not. So I think... No, the third Moshe Shabbos. From this Moshe Shabbos.
What time?
Is it okay to like just survey quickly if people would come?
People want to come.
To, not this Motzei Shabbos, but the following one. Would anyone?
Ben Osman and Motzei Shabbos. If people want, you can tell Yishai later. I'll be open.
Okay.